can shape our lives. This morning, we're going to be looking at the second and third chapter of the book of Leviticus. If you've been here for any length of time, you will know that we have just kicked off a study in the book of Leviticus called Remember and Act. And we've been looking at these chapters in light of what we learned about the travels of the children of Israel in the last chapter of Exodus, where we saw that God had moved his presence into the tabernacle at the center of the camp. And the question that the book of Leviticus sets out to answer for God's people is simply this: how do I live with God at the center of the camp? Or for us today, how do we live with God at the center of our lives? And this morning we're going to look at the chapter 2 and chapter 3. One of them outlines the grain offering, the other one outlines the peace offering. Both of those offerings, though, are united by one theme. And I think this theme is particularly relevant for us today. And if you listen to the scriptures that James read for us this morning, you will see that there was a theme that was woven all the way through that. And that is that God delights to live in fellowship and to feast, if you will, with his covenant people. We live in a world where it's easy for us to feel alone, to feel afraid, to feel tired, to feel exhausted, to feel cynical, to feel all these emotions that life in a broken and dark world brings into our lives. And the reality is that even in what we would consider to be some of the driest parts of the Old Testament, God is reminding his people that we were created for fullness and for fellowship with him. To kind of start thinking about this, how many of you like Christmas dinners? Well, let's make the question even easier. How many of you have been to a Christmas dinner? All right, this is going to get you. Okay. How many of you like them? Come on, seriously, that's all? All right. Those of you who are my family who didn't raise your hand, Christmas is canceled this year. We'll see how that goes. All right. So why do you like a Christmas dinner? What is it that you like about it?
Food.
Food, okay. What else?
Fellowship.
Fellowship, okay. Family together, okay? So when we take food and fellowship and family together, what happens? If you happen to be in a family that can manage a Christmas dinner without family drama, no, I'm kidding. Now I'm really in trouble. Now they're canceling Christmas on me. I see how this is going to go, right? But when you live, when you have the opportunity to experience food and fellowship and family together, it really is this kind of almost magical moment that you really wish would never end, right? And I think the best comparison that you have as an adult is thinking back to the Christmas dinners of your childhood. I can't really think of a better example than this. Maybe others of you have better examples in your life. But typically at your grandparents' house, in that particular place in time, when the family was big enough to gather together, but not so big that you couldn't gather at grandma's house, and your grandmother was at the place in her life where she was able to take all of those things that she knew her grandchildren liked and serve them all to all of them on the same day. Right? Everybody knows kind of what I'm talking about here? We've all experienced that. You had just finished the meal, and probably within a few minutes of that, she'd make sure that you weren't malnourished and needing more snacks, right? And there was this kind of sense of abundance and delight. And based on the looks on your faces, I think you know what I'm talking about. But the reality is, that is the kind of thing that we look back at and wonder how we can recapture that feeling, that sense of fulfillment, that sense of completion. And the reason you can't grasp that is because sin entered the world, and that is just a little taste of what God gives to us as his children in eternity. And these two feasts in Leviticus, believe it or not, point out for us just how concerned God is with reminding his people in every time and in every place that he delights in being with them, and he wants them to delight in being not just with him, but with each other as well. See, the problem is sin has separated us from God. Isaiah chapter 59 tells us that our iniquities have separated us from God, and it goes on to say that our sins have hidden God's face from us. So there's something wrong with us, our sin, that hides God's face for us. But like the ancient Israelites, who could only see the presence of God filling the tabernacle, we can't see God's face because of sin. But we also know that God has promised in eternity this place of fullness and abundance and delight. Psalm chapter 16, right? You have made known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Right? The task and the question that our text asks us this morning is simply this: how do we get from sin and separation from God, the place where we know that we are standing guilty in sin, filled with dread, to a place where we can look forward to being with God and anticipating that moment in eternity where there will be pleasure and fullness of joy forevermore? Not the kind that is fleeting, not that kind of momentary perfection that you experience maybe at a family dinner or around a campfire on a perfect summer night, but instead where that is your reality for all of your existence in eternity. And I think as I was studying for this message, this is really the one thing that was impressed on my heart, is how God's plan for God's people has always included a way for them to understand that God delights in being with them and in them with each other. Turn with me in your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 2. We're going to read Leviticus chapter 2 and 3. We've got a fair bit of text to work our way through this morning, but I think we'll be able to do it if I can manage to avoid serving rabbit trails for your lunch. All right, starting Leviticus chapter 2, starting at verse 1. When anyone brings a grain offering to the Lord, his offering shall be a fine flour. He shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it and bring it to Aaron's sons, the priest. And he shall take from it a handful of the fine flour and oil with all of its frankincense, and the priest shall burn this as a memorial portion on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is a most holy part of the Lord's food offering. When you bring a grain offering baked in the oven as an offering, it shall be unleavened loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, or unleavened wafers smeared with oil. And if your offering is a grain offering baked on a griddle, it shall be of fine flour, unleavened, mixed with oil. You shall break it in pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. And if your offering is a grain offering cooked in a pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. And you shall bring the grain offering that is made of those things to the Lord. And when it is presented to the priest, he shall bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take from the grain offering its memorial portion and burn it on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is a most holy part of the Lord's food offerings. No grain offering that you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven nor any honey as a food offering to the Lord. As an offering of first fruits, you may bring them to the Lord, but they shall not be offered on the altar for a pleasing aroma. You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt.
If you offer a grain offering of first fruits to the Lord, you shall offer for the grain offering of your first fruits fresh ears, roasted with fire, crushed new grain. And you shall put oil on it and lay frankincense on it. It is a grain offering. And the priest shall burn as its memorial portion some of the crushed grain and some of the oil with all of its frankincense. It is a food offering to the Lord. Then moving over to chapter 3. If his offering is a sacrifice of peace offering, if he offers an animal from the herd, male or female, he shall offer it without blemish before the Lord, and he shall lay his hand on the head of his offering and kill it at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall throw blood against the sides of the altar. And from the sacrifice of the peace offering as a food offering to the Lord, he shall offer the fat covering the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver he shall remove with the kidneys. Then Aaron's sons shall burn it on the altar on top of the burnt offering, which is on the wood on the fire. It is a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. If his offering is for a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, is an animal from his flock, male or female, he shall offer it without blemish. If he offers a lamb for his offering, he shall offer it before the Lord. Lay his hand on the head of his offering and kill it in front of the tent of meeting. And Aaron's sons shall throw its blood against the sides of the altar. Then from its fat he shall remove the whole fat tail, cut off close to the backbone, and the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver he shall remove with the kidneys. And the priest shall burn it on the altar as a food offering to the Lord. If his offering is a goat, then he shall offer it before the Lord and lay his hand on its head and kill it in front of the tent of meeting. And the sons of Aaron shall throw its blood against the side of the altar. Then he shall offer from it as his offering for a food offering to the Lord, the fat covering the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver that he shall remove with the kidneys. And the priest shall burn them on the altar as a food offering with a pleasing aroma. All fat is the Lord's. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places, that you eat neither fat nor blood. So if you remember what we looked at in our last message, Rob, if I could have the next slide, please, when we looked at the burnt offering. The next two offerings that we're going to look at today are the grain offering and the peace offering as we work our way through this first section of Leviticus. And both of these offerings were voluntary offerings. They were offerings of thanksgiving for the Lord's provision and for care. And in the Hebrew language, the Hebrew word that describes the grain offering is a word called mincha, and I'm mispronouncing that, but it means tribute, and I want you to think about that for just a second. It's the kind of tribute that is given by a vassal or a vassal king to his overlord as a mark of his continuing goodwill and faithfulness. So think about a medieval serf who is taking his yearly tribute to the lord of the manor, or think about a peasant in Quebec taking his yearly harvest, portion of the harvest, to the seigneur in Quebec. Either one of those things is the same type of picture. Someone who is indebted to someone more powerful to them, bringing them something of value in exchange for their continued good favor. That's what's going on in this passage, right? For the audience of Jesus' time, this would have been the money that the tax collectors gathered in the governor's individual territories that would have then made its way to Herod's coffers, and then Herod would have forwarded his tribute off to the Roman emperor that allowed him to continue to govern his little piece of the kingdom, right? So there's this dynamic in this tribute offering of acknowledging that you are grateful to someone more powerful than yourself. And that's really what God is reminding his people of here, that they are called to be thankful by showing their tribute. We see this in the story of Jacob and Esau, right? You remember what happened with them. Jacob wants the birthright. He manages to trick his father into giving it to him. And he runs away because he's scared of his brother. And years later, he knows that he's going to meet him. And what does he do? Well, he does a whole lot of things to try to impress his brother. But the first thing that he does is send a minha, or a tribute, to his brother to buy his favor. And by doing that, he's acknowledging to Esau that his request is that he is hospitable to him, that he will not kill him or hurt him, but instead that he will look on him with favor, because he's acknowledging his role as Jacob as the lesser and Esau as the greater. Same thing when Joseph is ruling for Pharaoh in Egypt and his brothers bring an offering to him. It's the same kind of tribute offering, acknowledging the greater. But there's one thing that is always tucked in with this tribute offering that we so often forget, and that is very simply thankfulness. The cereal offering is a kind of tribute from the faithful worshiper to his divine Lord. So when that treaty was made, the conquered nations were expected to bring their tribute, but they were bound then, in return for accepting that tribute, they were bound to care for those people. Theologically, when God's people brought this cereal offering, the covenant required then God to show his favor to them. And this was associated with thanksgiving in terms of being shared as part of a meal, right? The first offering that we looked at in Leviticus, we see the entire animal being placed on the altar and being consumed. The grain offering, what happens here? A portion of it becomes the holy offering. It goes on the altar. The rest of it goes to where? When you bring the bread, baked, fried, whatever method of preparation, what happens with it? Some of it goes on the altar. The rest of it goes to support or to feed the priests, right? And there is a principle here in this symbolic meal that the priest and the worshiper share together, right? Where else do we see this in the church? Where do we eat a symbolic meal together? In the New Testament church. Communion. Yeah, that's okay. You can just speak a little louder, right? So when Jesus shares bread with his disciples, when Paul talks about how we share bread in the church, when we gather to eat this bread and drink this cup, we are remembering what is happening in this grain offering. We are acknowledging God's presence and provision as our overlord. And we are reminded once again to be grateful, or to live in thanksgiving, for what the way that he has provided for us, both materially and spiritually. The other element of this grain offering was that it was a reminder, if we could have the next slide, please, was that it was a reminder of God's provision for God's people for their daily bread, right? The Lord's Prayer says, give us this day our daily bread. And by presenting these grain offerings, the individual Israelite was expressing recognition and thankfulness for God's grace in providing his everyday blessings. And that's a difficult thing sometimes, I think, for us to remember. We live in a world where we don't often worry about where our next meal will come from. But you will note that once again, in all of the methods of preparing the grain offering, in all of the ways in which you could offer, it was always something that the most poor or the most economically disadvantaged in the nation of Israel could share in. It was
an offering of fine flour simply because it was the most common food. Even the poorest of the pure could present a small measure of flour. Remember, unlike our culture, bread products, not meat, were the common food on the table for most people in those times, right? Meat is a delicacy. When we're reading Leviticus, you need to remember that meat is a delicacy that's often only enjoyed by royalty or the wealthy or by ordinary families on very, very special occasions. So when they're offering this grain offering, they, in verses 4 to 10 of chapter 2, they choose the method of cooking that they're going to bring it to them. So whether they can prepare this in a griddle, whether they don't have, and if they're wealthy enough to have an oven, they can prepare it in the oven. If they have a griddle, they can prepare it on the griddle. If all they can do is make a little wafer on a frying pan or a metal slab of some kind over a crude fire, that offering is acceptable. It didn't have to be a specific loaf, a specific shape. This particular offering allows for three different methods of preparation, right? There's so many ways that God is making this fellowship accessible to everybody in the nation. He talks about frankincense. We know that frankincense was an expensive spice, right? Once again, if you had it, you could add it, but if it wasn't there, the offering was still received anyhow. And in fact, the frankincense would often get added, we see in chapter 2, at the tabernacle, but only to the portion that was being put on the altar, not to the portion that was eaten by the worshiper and by the priest, because this was first and foremost, this was not just bringing food to the priests. This was first and foremost a gift of what you had to the God who had provided for you. That was an act of worship directed first and really only to the Lord God. But there was one ingredient that was required, verses 11 to 13. And that is salt. And without jumping down a long and very interesting rabbit trail on the history of salt covenants and how salt is such a marker of hospitality and care in biblical times, remember this. Salt is simply, when you see that term in the Bible, a reminder of God's eternal covenant with his people. Numbers chapter 18, verse 19. It was always in the ancient Near East a sign of commitment to loyalty and to hospitality. But that was a two-way covenant. The people must remain loyal on both sides of that salt covenant. So the salt, the addition of the salt, reminded the Israelite worshiper of the reason for bringing the gift. And we know, because we've read more than just Leviticus, that it was easy in the history of Israel's worship for the people to carry out the ritual, but to forget the meaning or to lose sight of the relationships. And the tendency of humanity has always been to disconnect the actions of our hands from the motivations of our hearts. And this is just another way that God outlines in his word to remind us again and again that we should keep from that disconnect in our own lives. He also talks, when the law is given here, about the need for the offering to be pure. He specifically prohibits the addition of yeast and of honey. Right? We know that yeast does wonderful things to bread if you're going to eat it. But in Leviticus, yeast is a symbol for the evil that corrupts the people of God. It's the same reason honey is prohibited. Because introduced into the dough, it could lead to fermentation, which would in turn lead to a similar effect as the yeast in the bread. So in essence, what they were to bring was pure flour mixed with a little oil and nothing else, as a reminder that they were called to be pure people, separate from the nations around them, and worshiping God. But most interestingly, verses 12, 14, 15, and 16. What were they supposed to bring? They were supposed to bring the first fruits. Why is that important? The fresh ears were the first bit of grain that were ripe, that were supposed to be roasted and ready to give on the altar. What are the first fruits? It's kind of in the name, right? It's the first part of the harvest. So why is that an act of faith? I need a farmer here. Somebody want to volunteer to be part of this illustration for a second? If you have two fields of grain and you are a farmer, and God is calling you for your first fruits, and you give him the yield off of your first field as your offering, what is the act of faith there? This is important. You're assuming that the second field is going to yield. Do you understand this? So God is asking his people to live in full dependence on him by saying, when you see that field that is just perfect and ripe and ready to harvest, I want you to harvest it, and then I want you to take all of that first bit of harvest, and I want you to get rid of it all. Feed me, feed the priests. You see the faith that that took. It's the same way for us, right? The New Testament tells us that we are to give ourselves and our best to the Lord. The New Testament tells us that Jesus is the first fruits of the resurrection, and that one day we will join him as the first fruits of the new creation. And that, I think, for us, is a real challenge to the way that we consider how we give to the Lord. Do we give out of our abundance, or do we give out of our scarcity? Is our giving an act of dependence, or is giving something that happens after we assume that we have what we need to be independent? And we see the same theme here continued in the peace offering in chapter 3, where the theme really is, when we read those three different types of offering, that all of the fat belongs to the Lord. Think about this for a second. Put yourself in the shoes of an ancient Israelite. So your people was originally invited in that time of famine to come down to Egypt and to settle in the land of Goshen. Why? Because they were known for their skills as farmers and as herdsmen. So they were brought in to essentially improve the agriculture of Egypt. Over time, political regimes changed. They became an enslaved people, but they were still known for their ability to produce and husband the land and animals. And what does God do? He says, you're doing a good thing here, but I'm going to take you out of this place of abundance, which you're going to complain about later when you want to go back to the leeks and onions of Egypt, right? And I'm going to tell you that instead of being farmers and herdspeople, that I'm going to get you to take your families and you're going to head out of the fertile land of the Nile River Delta, and you are going to go into the deserts and the wastelands that are in northern Egypt and southern Palestine. And there, instead of being a farmer, you're going to actually have to figure out how to survive off of the food that you can find or the food that you're carrying with you, because you can't really grow any grain while you're traveling. And it's kind of hard to fatten a herd while that herd is walking its calories off every day as you move as part of this migration, right? So they're going from being a people who, even though they were in slavery, were in a place of material comfort. And instead, they are being called to live a life where everything that they know about depending on God for their daily bread is being thrown upside down. And we're going to see this come up again and again in Leviticus. But I want you to think about this in the context of the peace offering. What does God call them to give? He calls them to give their animals. Their animals without blemish. Their prized animals. The ones that they're going to depend on to perpetuate their flocks and herds when they arrive in the land of milk and honey that they've been promised. God says, you are my people, and you will show this to me by being willing to kill the best animals in your herds and flocks and bring it to me. He calls them, in essence, to kill and to share the prime cuts of the best animals of their herds. He calls them to kill their riches and then to offer them to him and depend on God, not yourself, for your existence. And that really is one of the big themes of the peace offering. The other element of the peace offering is that when this peace offering was made, it talks about a lamb, it talks about a bull, it talks about a goat, it talks about how you lay your hand on it. We went through this in our last message. It talks about how you kill it. And then what happens here? The first offering, Leviticus chapter 1, the whole animal goes onto the altar. Here, a portion of it goes onto the altar, a portion of it goes to the priests, and what happens with the rest of it? You take it home to eat. Meat is a treat, remember? You're not used to having it. If you live in a world without refrigeration, how quickly do you need to eat that meat? Fairly quickly, right? Else really bad things happen when you're trying to travel through the desert. So how do you eat a whole lot of meat quickly? What do? Share. You share it. Right? So we're all going over to Tony's place because he's got a brisket on the smoker or something like that, right? But you invite your friends and your family to gather because you have made this offering of thankfulness and dependence to God. And together, you share in this meal of fellowship and intimacy that is a reminder not just to you of your dependence on God, but it's a reminder to your friends and your family about how all of you are dependent on God. Not just for the bread that you have, but even for your continued success in the future, because you've sacrificed, if you will, the future of your flock. And by so doing, we see again and again that it is a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. This is something that brings joy to God. So one other thing I want to talk about here quickly when we think about the peace offering that I had to kind of wrap my head around. You notice again and again it talks about the portion of the animal that gets put on to the altar. Talks about how you take the organs and the fat and you put them on the altar. So in your house, when you have a nice, juicy cut, this would have been a really good sermon illustration. I could snack here, but this is hindsight. When you have a really good cut of meat, and you put it on the table. How many of you cut the fat off of it? Some of you, right? Why do we do that? Well, in our culture, fat is bad, right? You trim the fat before you serve the meal. What happens here? You see, in this culture, fat is actually the prime cut. The best part of the animal is the fatty part. That's the part that if you could afford to live literally on the fat of the land, then you were wealthy, you were affluent, you were prominent. If you gave the fat to God, you were taking your equivalent of the best cut of meat from your best animal and giving it to God and saying, here, this is for you. Why does that matter? You were giving the fat away. Remember, you're traveling, you're struggling for every calorie. And instead of getting the most calorie-dense portion of the animal as part of your diet, you're giving that away. You're offering that to God because God expects the best, even when it's a symbol of abundance. The other interesting rabbit trail with offering the rest of the organs is that a lot of times in other cultures around the people of Israel, they would take those organs and instead of burning them on the altar, the priests would use them to divine or to prophesy or to, in essence, do astrology or horoscopes with them. And God's call to his people is you take all of those things that the nation around you use for falsehood and you burn them as an offering to me because I am the one and only God. The last two verses of chapter 3. There is a prohibition against consuming the fat and the blood, but most importantly, it is a statute forever through Israel's generations. And what God is telling his people here is that his desire, God's desire, is to enjoy God's people as his people for all time. He is not a fickle king or a politician. His promise is reliable. This is God mentioning his intent to maintain his caring relationship for his people. Where? He says, in all your dwelling places, okay? So for all time and in all your dwelling places, no matter when you live or where you live, this relationship, this fellowship between God and his people is meant to be one that is permanent and lasting forever, right? We know that the covenant was broken by the people of Israel when they failed to keep the covenant statutes, but we know that God promised them a new covenant, and then he delivered this new covenant and established it through the blood of his only son. And because of the sacrifice of the Lord Christ, we, God's people today, in this time and in this place, can live in fellowship with a God who wants to live in intimate relationship with us. See, our Father in heaven wants nothing more than our full dependence on him, our desire for intimacy with him and with each other as we delight in the provision that he has made for us. Fellowship, Leviticus tells us, with God's people is a requirement and a gift, one that he uses to give us a taste, just a little taste in advance, a sip, if you will, of that eternal reality that awaits us as we consider what is real, not what is visible. Could we have a song at this time, Jeremy?